In 2021, Swedish scholar activist Andreas Malm published How to Blow Up a Pipeline, a book that is not an instruction manual and does not actually call for blowing up pipelines, but does argue for greater militancy in the climate movement, chiefly in the form of blockades, occupations, climate camps, similar mass direct action. In 2022, director Daniel Goldhaber, screenwriters Ariella Barrère and Jordan Scholl, and editor Daniel Garber released a film loosely inspired by Malm's book. It takes the provocative title, the general idea that causing property damage is morally justified in the fight against climate change, and not much else. It's a fictional thriller using the genre of the heist film, showing a ragtag group of outsiders coming together to pull off one big action.
So, Fran, it's been common to say that the book was better than the movie, but what does this movie even have to do with Andreas Malm's book beyond its incendiary title?
It doesn't have a lot. It's a very different work. It's fictional. It's a drama narrative. The book is a nonfiction manifesto or polemic. It's not a narrative. And the filmmakers stress that they wanted to make a mainstream genre film that would reach a wider audience than the book had. And the book starts from pointing out that since the Congress of Parties first meeting in 1995, the climate situation has only gotten worse. There's more emissions, CO2 levels are rising, the crisis is accelerating. So clearly, the big actions, and Malm talks about waves of mass climate action and activism that people have engaged in over the years. And all of that has not slowed the pace of the disaster that keeps coming. So something else is needed is sort of the premise that he starts from. And that idea is sort of similar in the film. Something else is needed, that whatever's been happening so far is not enough. The book has three chapters. The first one sort of takes apart the argument for strategic pacifism that has been popular, particularly with the UK XR movement that has stressed nonviolence and cooperation with police and other questionable things like that. And Malm really dismantles the arguments for that, saying that it's not clear that nonviolent action is always more effective. He also, in the second chapter, then he goes on to argue for a kind of radical flank movement. The most famous example of that historically is in the US, the civil rights movement, where Martin Luther King was able to point out Black people are angry and they're going to act out. And if you don't take some action to deal with the nonviolent protesters, you're just going to have to deal with the violent ones. So Malm sort of argues for the need for a radical flank to push a movement left and to get something done, that the peaceful sort of mainstream of progressive climate activism has not had much positive effect in the big picture. And then he has a last chapter arguing against climate despair and for the need to keep acting in the face of the onrushing disaster. The film is really trying to make a left of mainstream film, but mainstream enough to reach a wide audience. So they've chosen a heist film, which is a kind of ensemble piece. So they've got a group of characters selected as sort of representatives of people who are particularly harmed by the fossil fuel industry and the climate crisis. So it's an illustration of why some people might want to blow up a pipeline.
Yeah, each character in the film has a backstory, though, one of the things that's kind of compelling about it as a heist film is that it starts just in the action, in the actual deployment of their bomb building, and the kind of backstory for each character, which is significant, comes in as flashbacks throughout the process of them going out to this site on what was one of the characters' land before a fossil fuel company through eminent domain had taken it from him in order to expand their pipeline. We have a couple different college students who are trying to take action around climate change. They're involved in a campus divestment movement, but then also trying to produce awareness-raising film about those who are impacted by fossil fuels, including the character whose land we go out to in the film. And each character has something to say about the background idea of there being a movement for changing the world for a better place, especially in regards to climate change. And what I think is interesting, but also a little underwhelming about this, is that their characterization of the movement focuses on eco-liberal tactics and strategies that look to existing channels for social change, that stress the incrementalism of social change, that stress the market as a mediator for social action. But ultimately, they are also trying to affect the market by blowing up this pipeline. And there isn't a whole lot of connection to movements beyond how they have cynically turned away from what they feel are ineffective movements.
Yeah, we see some of the characters engaging in low-level sabotage. There's a tire slashing, which is a kind of riff on something that Malm talks about in the book, where a group of activists in Sweden put pebbles in the valves of tires of SUVs and left notes saying why they were doing it. The pebble in the valve action causes no harm to the tire and is perhaps less visually striking than slashing a tire with a knife. There are other characters who we see, I guess they're pouring sugar into a gas tank for some equipment. Those are the anarchist or whatever punks from Portland. And then there's a Native American character who's furious at the fossil fuel workers on his people's traditional land. Although the only response action we see from his community is his mother is involved in some seed saving project.
The Conservancy.
So we see some gesture toward there being efforts in the direction of climate action, but we don't see mass movements. We don't see the Standing Rock occupation. We don't see blockades or any of those actions, which are actually the kinds of things that Malm ends up recommending. We also don't see the characters considering the role of the legal system. I mean, one of the things that the director has said in interviews is that he's in favor of the importance of the necessity defense for climate action, that it is morally justified and therefore arguably legally justified. And we have seen some success of the necessity defense, for instance, in Portland, where activists planted a garden blocking the trains that Zenith was using to bring in tar sands oil. Their case ended in essentially a hung jury, but most of the jurors were in favor of acquitting them and they weren't retried. So that's moving toward a successful necessity defense. And the argument for the necessity defense is partly that it gets the word out, that it shifts the legal ground available. But there's nothing in the film about, like, nobody seems to have contacted a lawyer about the situation that they're in, even though there is a mention that one of them has a family lawyer. He's apparently the trust fund activist. There's very little attention to the larger legal or collective actions that people have taken, might be taking in relation to climate.
The film is trying to make a case for eco-terrorism, and it is somewhat successful in that it portrays everything is going mostly as planned. They, spoiler alert, they don't just show you how to blow up a pipeline, they do it. And they, you know, have several conversations while they're doing this about how they're going to be labeled as terrorists. And in fact, the couple, Logan and Rowan, Rowan is caught when they are trying to sabotage that equipment. And she is basically coerced by the FBI into becoming an informant. And this is one of the less believable, although I think it strokes the ego of some folks who are watching it. It's less believable that they will trick the FBI, which is what she sets out to do. Logan says, you know, I don't want you to rat out on my friends. And so they're like, okay, well, let's find somebody else. And then they get involved in this plot by just happening to run into one of the other characters in a bookstore. And, you know, when they're talking about terrorism, they're also making valid points about how when people challenge authority, they get labeled with terrorism. I mean, we had a local experience with this just last month when Portland Association of Teachers, in addition to their rallies in the center of town, had peaceful rallies and pickets in the neighborhoods of some of PPS's management which the lawyers for PPS challenged this in court by saying that it violated labor law and constituted terrorism. That is like actually in their court filings that this was a terrorist act. So it is worth thinking about how they are trying to face down that fear of doing the right thing is going to get labeled as, you know, the worst kind of evil. And at the same time, they're slipping between the idea of the radical flank as an expression of a larger movement that has other means of power available to it, and somehow leading the movement, being a game changer, as one of the characters refers to the idea of blowing up the pipeline, or revolutionaries. There's this kind of sense of nothing else is going to work, and so we're going to be the spearhead for what will work, and that's just not how it works.
This is definitely not something anyone should take as a guide to how to go about blowing up a pipeline. I mean, I think in the book, the title is maybe an attempt at a kind of rhetorical radical flank. You open it thinking, oh, this is about blowing up pipelines. And then the argument is not that we should be blowing up pipelines, but that we should be engaging in blockades and occupations and mass actions of less incendiary sorts. So I think the book might be using that kind of tactic to move people. The film is not doing the same kinds of thing because it's showing this action of blowing up a pipeline as though it can work this easily. And these people have not taken any consideration to security culture. They're randomly hooking up with other people they meet through videos and in bookstores and not checking, like, who do you know? And how do I know that you're not an informant or a plant or an agent trying to entrap us? Because there is a lot of that out there. They do say important things about the inflation of the idea of terrorism, right? Showing up at somebody's house on a public street to peacefully protest is apparently now terrorism in Portland, right? The people who've been arrested in Georgia in the Atlanta forest are being charged with felonies for things like signing instead of their name when they're arrested, ACAB. I mean, for buying food for people engaging in occupation. And there are all sorts of laws being put on the books about damage to critical infrastructure that heightens the danger of all of these things. So we're not getting any guidance on security culture. I mean, the FBI shenanigans reminded me of the 1973 movie The Sting, which is a light comedy from the 70s in which there is a similar kind of we tricked the FBI moment in the narrative. And in that, it's light, it's funny, it's set during the Depression, it's in the past, it's not meant to be taken too seriously. But here, it seems like there is perhaps some reason that someone might think you could get away with doing this, and the FBI would not swoop in, arrest everybody before anything got blown up, and lock them away for a really long time.
There's a long history, a century at least, of the bomb-throwing anarchist as this boogeyman of the left. And there is also a real history of anarchists wanting to engage in what was called propaganda of the deed, which in fact involved blowing things up or otherwise trying to cause significant damage that would be a spectacle that would somehow be an inspiration to the masses to wake up. And what we also see, though, in the history of sabotage, which is a word that has a very kind of specific origin in the labor movement. The sabo was the wooden shoe of the Dutch workmen that was apocryphally thrown into the gears as an act of resistance to capitalist modernity. And in the early days of the industrial workers of the world, there was a open embrace of the term sabotage. In fact, the iconic Sabo Tabby is a nod to the pervasiveness of this term and the ideas associated with it. But in practice, Marxist historian who passed away a couple of years ago, Mike Davis, did an incredible historical investigation of the early IWW's praxis around sabotage and shows that rather than being overly focused and single-minded about property destruction as the linchpin of catalyzing revolutionary agency, Sabotage was a flexible toolkit of tactics that involved direct engagement with the means of production and the obstruction of that. But it was much more about having the mass capacities of labor at the means of production in control of itself in a way that brought things to a halt. Of course, there were union workers who bombed railroads and who did this kind of terroristic activity, but it became apparent that the clandestine organizing that the IWW was doing to withhold their labor in strategic ways that were not a spectacle like the big strikes of the 1930s, and that would become the kind of only weapon that labor was allowed to deploy occasionally after the National Labor Relations Act was passed, that there's a parallel to this history of repressing the real power of mass politics and of the revolutionary agency of the working class realizing that nothing happens without us and we have the power. And so there is something, you know, potentially regressive or reactionary in the film that cynically turns away from that tradition and from that analysis of how power works, that Malm's book, you know, does not make that mistake. It starts with a provocation, but then it's really an entry point into, rather than how do we literally blow up a pipeline, how do we figuratively blow up the pipelines with different kinds of mass actions that put their hands on the means of production?
Yeah, so Sabotage originally is really about stressing and illustrating the ways that workers have the power, that profit can be interrupted because it is something that comes out of the actions of the people who are doing the work. And it requires and entails this organized action, whereas the film has this small group. So it's an ensemble piece, and they've tried to choose a genre that favors sympathy with the outlaw and a group of people rather than a single protagonist. But it remains a dramatic narrative that's very much dependent on individual characters. And that's not a kind of narrative that is adequate to the historical moment or to the how-to of what really needs to happen.
It's probably more palatable these days when the Avengers movies are some of the most popular films out there. But it is a cynical retreat from the very sort of political analysis we need in order to effectively strategize and take the kinds of actions that are going to change things.
On the plus side, it's a provocation. It's a discussion prompt. It's something that if you watch it with your comrades and your workmates and your affinity group, you can talk about these issues and what needs to happen and the particulars of your place and time and the particular actions that might be available to you and their various pros and cons. So in that sense, it can be a useful tool as well as an entertaining heist film.
You know, to the filmmaker's credit, they do explicitly direct viewers to their website in order to gain access to the book. And in that way, it can be seen as playing with this idea of the radical flank and working with the realities of mass media and how you get a different kind of audience to check something out that will actually make sense to them if you know how to lead them to it.
People might want to see a heist film without having much investment in thinking through these issues and might have some further thoughts on the basis of having seen the film. Although one hopes they would then talk to other people about whether this is a realistic portrayal.
The film's characters have a lot to say about the weaknesses of the climate movement. And the film itself, I think, gives us an opportunity to think through the weaknesses of a particular kind of pivot away from those politics as normal, those existing channels sorts of means of social change. And the film's weaknesses can actually be an asset for pushing this conversation forward. Because while the characters in the film are turning away from what they see as the weaknesses of the environmental movement, the film is showing us or is providing the opportunity for us to think about the weakness of actually blowing up a pipeline as a strategy for climate change And it kind of forces us to step away from this dualism or this false dichotomy of either you have to be a eco-liberal and do things incrementally, or you have to step away from mass politics altogether and do something dramatic and be a revolutionary vanguardist or something. And kind of shocks our thinking into an openness to being somewhere in the middle or outside of that duality.
So there is a potential for a kind of radical flank effect in seeing the film, in responding to the film. There is an irony in the fact that the filmmakers within the film, the videographers who are trying to raise awareness, are seen as really ineffectual. This is not enough. And yet we're watching a film that is raising awareness. So it's reminding us that it's not enough to just watch the movie. But someplace between just watching the movie and going out and blowing up a pipeline, there's a lot of territory for action. So a lot of the things that the characters say in the course of the dialogue are provocative and helpful about the ease of labeling things terrorism, for instance. Perfectly reasonable actions get called terrorism and people suffer mightily for having done things that are morally right. So there is that recognition. Some of the dialogue and the rationales that the characters give are much more questionable, like the idea that they are going to manipulate the market by blowing up this single pipeline. They are going to bring down the fossil fuel industry. I mean, they don't quite go that far in their claims, but they do suggest that it can be a way of manipulating the market and thus intervening, which suggests that we can use capitalism to change the damage that capitalism is doing.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, different characters lament the slowness of social change when it is approached through divestment or through advocacy. And at the same time, they are looking to the market to be the mediator for social change. That it's not even blowing up the pipeline is going to be what materially changes things. It's going to be how that impacts market actors and their decisions. And so they are vested with really having the power in society to then drop this bad investment. And when fuel prices go up, that is going to have these ripple effects, and it depoliticizes the climate movement and kind of leaves us in the same position as we were before.
There are arguments for making exploration and exploitation of oil too expensive, too difficult for companies to pursue. There's some thinking that perhaps in the case of Shell's drilling in the Arctic, the blockade of the Fennica that kept the ship from getting there in time for that drilling season had some effect, but that wasn't the only thing in play in their decision. They also weren't finding as much oil as they'd hoped, and there were other problems that they were facing. So Shell pulled out of that one area, and maybe the blockade of the Fennica had some impact. But of course, Shell is still in business. Drilling is still going on all over the place. So it's a very local effect.
Yeah, I think that the takeaway, or one of the takeaways from this film, especially seen in light of the book that it's loosely based off of, is that this kind of dramatic action may be justified, but it is not the leading edge of social change. It is something that has to be in a practical relationship with movements that then deploy those tactics strategically. In the case of the early labor movement, it was the fact that workers were struggling day to day over the nature of work, the pace of work, that built their militancy so that when the big strikes came, the bosses didn't know that they were just going to end after the legally prescribed time. They were a sign of a power that could keep growing. And so that is what we need to do. We need to build the base for power so that if we get to the point where dramatic action is taken, that it doesn't just evaporate after the action.
And if people are engaging in sabotage, they don't necessarily need to get caught. That might not be the best tactic. In the film, there's a pretense that, no, it was just these two people. They're the only ones who were involved. But if no one knows who was involved, if the FBI doesn't have that information, true or false, they can imagine that there are swarms, multitudes out there ready to engage in further blockade, occupation, sabotage.
Well, I'm Joe Clement. I've been talking with Fran Michel for the Olmo Variety Hour about the 2022 climate action heist, How to Blow Up a Pipeline. You can find this film on Hulu or for free at your local library on DVD or streaming through the Canopy service. Now, you can get a copy of Andreas Malm's book at the local library or for free as an ebook through the publisher Verso using the code PIPELINE, which you can find through the film's website. Look for links to all of these when the show is posted.
I had a job once, threshing wheat, worked 16 hours with hands and feet. And when the moon was shining bright, they kept me working all the night. One moonlit night, I hate to tell, I accidentally slipped and fell. My pitchfork went right in between the cogwheels of that thresh machine. Ta-ra-ra, boom, da, it made a noise that way. And wheels and bolts and hay went flying every way. That stingy rook said, well, 1,000 shots, hell. I did sleep well that night. I needed it all right. And then that farmer said, you jerk, I'll bet you are, and I won't work. He paid me off right then, by gum. So I went home and told my chum. Next day when threshing did commence, my chum was Johnny on the fence. On my word, that awkward kid, he dropped his pitchfork like I did. Ta-ra-ra, boom, da, it made a noise that way. And part of that machine hit Reuben on the beam. He cried, oh me, oh my, I nearly lost an eye. My partner said, that's right, it's bedtime now, good night. Wise, these things did open up his eyes. He said, there must be something wrong. I think I work my men too long. He cut the hours and raised the pay, gave ham and eggs for every day. Now gets his men from union halls, has no accidents at all. Ta-ra-ra, boom, da, that Rube is feeling gay. He learned his lesson quick through just a simple trick. For fixing rotten jobs and curing greedy.